Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for the last week of May 2010. I'm reporter Elise Hugh, joined by CEO and editor-in-chief Evan Smith.
Hi, Elise.
Managing editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
And Ben Philpott from the Tribune and KUT News.
Hello.
Today we're talking about the Texas Tribune University of Texas poll numbers, digging a little deeper into those, Rick Perry's forthcoming book, and the Green Party in Texas. So we'll start with Evan and Ross and the numbers.
Rick Perry is still ahead, just like he was in February.
You think it's boring. I think it's awesome.
I don't think it's boring. It's just, you know, it hasn't moved. You know, I'm a fan of motion.
But inaction is its own form of action, Ross. Contemplate that. The fact is, Perry being up by 9
Kierkegaard.
Is itself news. I mean, what it shows is that in the 2 months since White's been the nominee and the money that White has spent on ads on television and in print and some on the web and all this talk and attempting to brand himself, that really the stick has not moved. And in fact, the Rasmussen poll at least suggested that it's moved farther back for him. In that a month ago it was 4 points and now it's, they say it's 13, we say it's 9, but certainly what it says is both polls, our poll, their poll, he has work to do.
Three things happened between our polls that were sort of interesting and you would otherwise think would change these numbers. The first of these polls was February.
Right.
And showed him 9 points apart just like they are now. Perry did about $7 or $8 million worth of advertising to win the Republican primary after that poll. We had a Republican primary between him and Kay Bailey Hutchison. He did a bunch of advertising. Another thing that happened in there was that the federal health plan passed. Boy, try that three times.
Yeah, right.
And that crystallized some of the antipathy toward Washington. And the third thing that happened, as you say, is Bill White started advertising in Houston where you'd think he was strong. And none of those three things seem to move the numbers in the governor's race, or all of those three things, you know, however, that it all settled out in about the same place.
Now, if you're White, you got a couple good pieces of news out of this poll, I think. One is that Perry is at 44%. So he is well below what is the accepted, for reasons I can't frankly tell you, but it just is, the accepted good reelect number for incumbents, 50%. If you're not at 50%, then that's said to be not good. And so he is well below that. White's also got time on his side. In theory, quote, no one is paying attention, close quote, to this race.
Right.
And it really only matters around Labor Day. Now, I seem to remember, Elise, a conversation with you months ago about how Hutchison's campaign was saying, well, no one's paying attention to the primary. They're only going to start paying attention after the first of the year. Check back with me then. How'd that work out?
And we're still waiting for Kay Bailey Hutchison to do the debrief on her campaign. So.
Well, and if you go back to the Hutchison-Perry campaign, about a year ago, Hutchison was still ahead in that race. The last poll, there was one exception to this, but the last poll in the trend line that showed her ahead of Perry was in June of that year.
Right. So,
you know, around this time of year. And then the trend line was pretty solid from there on out. So, you know, the White has time to do something with. It's not clear that he has surfaced the issues that'll move these numbers at all.
Particularly
with white voters and
small W white voters.
Yeah, Anglo voters. This has become quite a writing trick now.
It really is, right? Yeah.
You know, they're running relatively even in the cities. It's kind of interesting. If you sort of look at the major metros, White and Perry are running, you know, close enough in the cities to call it a competitive race. But in the not cities part of Texas, Rick Perry is just murdering him. It's just killing him. And so White's got to figure out how to move those numbers.
Well, who do you think he's running against more, White, that is? Is White running against Perry, or is he running against the evil federal government?
I think elections like this, when you've got a 10-year incumbent, it's all about the incumbent. And, you know, people just so far have not exhibited a giant migration away from Rick Perry. And, you know, Bill White's got to, you've got to get them off the product they're using before you can get them to use the new product.
I think that Perry has done an excellent job, though, of making sure that it's not about him, it's about everything else.
Boy, Ben, you're exactly right. This race needs to be conducted as Rick Perry versus not Rick Perry. Anytime it becomes a race about Bill White, that's not good for White. Now, the white people will object to that. They'll say reasonably there are many good things about White and many things that people like about White. But this has got to be conducted as a referendum on the incumbent.
Right.
And so the Perry campaign has very artfully, I think, made this race about White so far. Day 72 of liberal trial lawyer Bill White not releasing his taxes. Metrogate, this, that, the other. They're focusing on White, White, White. The white people have tried to focus it back on Perry, but it's been very difficult to do it. And if this race is conducted as Perry versus White, that's bad for White. If it's conducted as Perry versus not Perry, there's a good not Perry vote out there that I think is persuadable.
It's sort of the warehouse of scary things. Bill White wants you to be afraid of Rick Perry. Rick Perry wants you to be afraid of Democrats in Washington and, you know, White by association.
Right. So maybe what White needs to do is just run a bunch of ads of Perry. Don't introduce yourself. Reintroduce Perry.
Well,
right. Maybe he needs to be focusing
on. That's actually what Perry's
done
very successfully to, let's see, Kay Bailey Hutchison, Tony Sanchez, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
That's true. That's true.
Ross, what else is in those numbers regarding the issues?
Well, we had some education numbers. They're sort of interesting. People don't have a lot of confidence in public schools in Texas. Now, we didn't ask questions. We got a lot of comments and a lot of calls about, well, did you ask them what they think of their own school? This is kind of that congressman question where...
I hate Congress, but I like Congress, my
but I like my guy, right. Yeah. So the question, you know, there's still an open question out there about, you know, I hate public schools, but I like mine. I do like the public school where my daughter is. You know, the policy question is... You know, not about what do you think of the school you're in. It's what does the legislature do politically with public perception that public schools aren't going well. One of the things I talked to Rob Eisler in the House and Scott Hochberg in the House about yesterday in talking about these was one of the things people say is, well, what if you spent more money, you know, particularly on college, you know, would that help? And both of those guys say, you know, opposites, right? One of them, you know, Eisler says, you know, there's no correlation between spending more money and raising performance. Hochberg says, you know, we're short-sheeting these guys in a lot of areas.
I think the big takeaway, or a big takeaway, I think that it's really interesting that so many Texans have shaky confidence or no confidence in the public schools. I was just as interested to see the percentage of Texans above 50% in most cases who agreed in principle with many of the changes made by the State Board of Education. The dreaded, evil, stereotyped, you know, nationally mocked State Board of Education, even
right.
mocked by many people in this state. You know, a lot of Texans are actually in support of
Bible
what
class
doing.
Electives in high school,
right.
The importance of Christianity to the founding fathers, the importance of free market America.
Free market is awesome. That stuff.
The one place where they disagreed a little bit was the State Board lowered the requirement for how much you have to say as a history teacher. Ethnic and racial minorities contributed to America. They didn't say you have to lower it. They lowered the requirement. And only 35% of Texans approved
and
that.
And that was a big controversy during the debate because you had the Mexican-American Democratic caucus, you know, having hearings, in fact, on this notion of taking ethnic minorities, racial minorities out of the history books. And yet it sounds like that may be the one area in which Texans are in agreement with the antis in the state board debate. The other thing that I just thought was really interesting was that two-thirds of Texans thought that the notion of too much religion in the public schools was not a problem.
Not a problem. Not a
and
problem.
That just feels to me completely inconsistent with the tradition in this country of leaving religion out of the schools, which seems to be the problem that the State Board was trying to rectify.
Well, the way the question was asked, if they're not dealing with religion in the public schools, then you would say that's not a problem. I mean, you sort of combine two groups here. You know, it's a group that thinks that it's, you know— No, that's not really a problem. The group that thinks there's a lot of it and there's not really a problem. So
I was on MSNBC right? this morning, as you know, talking about the State Board with Chuck Todd.
Uh-huh.
And I actually had my back up very quickly because he was kind of snotty about it. And
was he interviewing Evan Smith on behalf of Crazy Texas? Was it?
Well, basically, yeah, you know, and I kind of thought to myself, well, shut up, buddy. I mean, you know, don't start, you know, knocking Texas.
As far as we know, no elementary teacher allowed students to dress in as Klan members in Texas like they did in Georgia a couple of days ago.
For instance, and you've lived
well,
in Georgia.
Everybody's
got
to have somebody to be
have
better
you not?
Than.
I've lived near Georgia.
Do you want to defend it?
No.
I actually can understand that there's an awful lot of pushback by Texas institutionally against the national view of the state board.
Right.
I do it's yet another disconnect between the press, which probably views the State Board of Education's changes with a little bit more amusement and maybe even contempt, and where Texas is. This poll has shown that Texans are standing with the State Board and against the media. You know, imagine that.
One other point in the education stuff that was kind of interesting just along the way was that most Texans don't, or that a huge number of Texans don't think having a college degree is important to success in the workplace. And think, in fact, more than half say, you know, there's plenty of ways to get by.
And all of us who are parents getting ready to pay tuition for kids in college are going, thank God.
Right.
And great. I don't have to send you.
And then the companion was, if you're listening, Jenna Ramsey, here's your world. And the companion to that was that only 37% of them think that everyone who is qualified to go to college has the opportunity to do so in Texas. Which I thought was really, you know, a very interesting
and vaguely depressing.
You know, take on the higher ed situation.
Oh, well, just one quick note I wanted to make about the SBOE thing was that I think that it's not that surprising that the majority of Texans would be in favor of some of those ideas, like inserting more religion into schools, if asked that way. But I think the separate issue is the politicization of the state board. So, like, inserting ideology left or right into the state board. So if the questions were separated, if it was, you know, let me ask you specifically on this point versus let me ask you specifically if you agree with these principles, then it might be different.
Well, and we've had a little response already on whether or not you think the state board should be politicized. We've had, you know, McElroy losing his primary.
Right.
McElroy losing, Geraldine Miller losing.
There was another thing in here that voters have totally assimilated all this information. So we split this question where we said, what do you think about public schools in Texas? And we asked half of them that question and then asked them this series of questions about, do you agree with the state board on this and this and this and this and this? And then the other half, who hadn't answered the first question, we asked them, okay, so now that you've heard all of that, how do you feel about public education in Texas? And the stuff in the middle didn't matter at all. They felt the same way about
public. The same, they
felt the same way. Same as group two. It's very interesting. They've already assimilated that information.
Yeah.
All right. Let's shift to my topic this week, which is that Rick Perry has a book coming out this fall. It's going to be called Fed Up. Publisher Little Brown is going to be putting it out, and it's going to be a polemic about the federal government and how states need to.
Well, I guess we assume it's going to be a polemic, right? It's I'm assuming it's not a.
From Fed Up, I'm just guessing.
You're guessing a happy book? No, okay.
So, you know, there's all this talk about Rick Perry possibly running for president. He obviously told Evan earlier this year that he's definitely not. But this kind of putting out a major book, especially about railing against the federal government, really sounds to me like a setting yourself up for some sort of
maybe he's just trying to get a big advance in royalties so he can buy all those cooking magazine subscriptions for the house.
Or Coyote Specials, his new gun.
Yeah, I mean, I don't dismiss out of hand the possibility that he just simply had the opportunity to make a bunch of money writing a book.
Right.
Right? I mean,
Obama did it.
Timing is interesting.
Well, you know,
this Dreams from My Coyote could actually be this book.
As an exercise, let me play the Perry side of this for a minute. As an exercise in political power, saying I'm not running for president and acting like you're not running for president, you know, the first doesn't do anything to your political power. If you actually act like you're not running for president and withdraw from all of this stuff, your political power diminishes. If you act like you're still a contender, it could still happen. If there's a little bit of doubt, well, I better go talk to Perry. Mitt Romney comes down to Houston this week. You know, you keep that option alive as a political possibility just to keep, you know, your political power going. Now, I think, you know, there's a long tradition here and elsewhere of saying, I'm not going to do it. Oh, shoot, if you guys insist, I'll go ahead and run.
The country really needs me right now.
His option's open here.
But the other part of this is, and it's vaguely Palin-esque here, it's arguable whether there's more power in being the guy who runs in a pack of people who all want to be president and it's going to be an uphill battle, or being the leader of a movement to whom people come and ask for your grace to be bestowed, basically. Yeah. What did Romney do? Romney came and sought out Rick Perry, who didn't even like him during the last presidential election.
Right. Went for that Giuliani kid.
He went to seek out Perry to seek his blessing, basically.
To kiss his ring.
Kiss his ring. Is Perry more powerful as this guy, just as is Sarah Palin more powerful as a Fox commentator and the leader of a movement and a Facebooker than she would be as a candidate? I think arguably the former may be more powerful.
I think he is. I would draw a distinction between Perry and Palin on this. I think Palin's running. Perry's saying he's not running.
I'll bet you $100 she's not running.
But she says she's running.
And it's on tape.
She hasn't said she's not running in the same way Perry has. I mean, he's sort of going backwards. Yeah. It's an interesting juxtaposition with Bush, who had this, remember the show? All the people from around the country coming down to sort of, they had this quiet primary where everybody came down to Texas to see George Bush, and then he became the guy. Everybody else just slowly melted away from the race.
But the difference is Bush wanted to be king, and I think Perry has the potential to be kingmaker.
Right.
And that's there I think, there's is the distinction between that. Perry and Bush.
Right.
And
Perry's definitely branding himself. I mean, the title of the book, if you remember, is what you were supposed to text to his campaign in that secession speech.
That's true.
Text fed up to whatever the word.
Good get, Ben.
That's right.
I can't remember who gave the speech, but I remember what he said.
Or what the speech was about, or even who Perry is, or even who I am. But I remember the other stuff.
Now, to the issue of whether he can multitask and write a book
while he's still writing. Mark Miner's point in the article today, right?
Right.
Mark Miner told the Dallas Morning News, well, governors can multitask.
Right. So
Especially in a weak governor state.
We don't know whether he's sitting at his laptop every night or there's a ghostwriter helping him.
I wonder
him,
if he
both.
Has a concealed laptop, actually, so that while he's jogging, he can write this book.
Isn't that an iPad, the concealed laptop?
We have an attorney general candidate who wrote an entire book on a BlackBerry. Barbara Ann Radnofsky. So, I guess governors can multitask too.
She wrote a book on a BlackBerry
during the last campaign. Yeah, it was.
That is just crackers.
Just
you are kidding me.
No, I'm not kidding. I do not. Nonfiction is so much better than fiction.
Elise, shouldn't we seek the permission from Little Brown to excerpt this book?
Absolutely.
At the Tribune.
In fact, yeah. Story idea.
Don't you think?
Yeah, we should do.
God, you got that one. That's right. I don't see anything wrong with this. I mean, in the end, the governor's free to write a book. It's a free country still, and it's a book that there'll be people out there who will read it. Right? The activists will buy it.
Sure, they'll read it.
He'll go on a little tour of the country.
Every one of these candidates who is coming to Texas to figure out, how do I get Rick Perry's support, is going to read it and is going to incorporate whatever ideas there are to incorporate there. They're going to, this is a magpie book. Come take these ideas. As I learned from Rick Perry, this is all about an accumulation of political power.
Well, so here's my question. For those that have much larger institutional knowledge than I do, can you give me an example of the kingmaker that we think Rick Perry's trying to be?
Sarah Palin.
She's trying to run, I think.
Newt Gingrich.
Newt Gingrich.
Okay. All right.
Mark Hanna, how far back you want to do this?
And I think on the Democratic side, there have been a ton of people who were very Sherman-esque in their, in their pronouncements about their willingness to serve or run, but who were nonetheless enormous brands and who people sought out and sought the blessings of.
Like Kennedy after he lost to Carter?
Well, Mario Cuomo, even post-Donna Rice, Gary Hart, Bill Bradley in the last couple of cycles, frankly, Al Gore in the last cycle when he didn't run.
It's pretty simple. You look for people who are popular with the people you want to influence and you associate yourself with those people. I mean, Rick Perry's popular with this part, very popular with this part of the Republican Party right now, and it's kind of the enervated part of the Republican Party. These guys are energized, they're worked up. Perry seems to have the taproot, and if you're trying to get some of that, you got to come to Texas and see this guy.
Yeah.
Ben, now we shift to your topic. Is the Green Party
They're not kingmakers.
Resurgence or what?
Well, okay, so the Green Party turned in 93,000 signatures this week to the Secretary of State's office. That should get them on the general election ballot in 2010, which will be the first time they're on the ballot.
For which election or for every election?
For it gives them ballot spot.
Right, so they can run candidates up and down the ballot.
Yeah. So their slate gets on the ballot.
Yes, thank you. Their slate gets on the ballot. And first time since 2002 that they've been able to do this. They say partially because of money, it can cost between $100,000 and $500,000 to pay a company to get signatures in the state of Texas. Partially because of the rules, which include things like it's about 44,000 signatures, you have 75 days to collect it, and they can't have voted in a primary.
Right, they've got to be registered voters who didn't vote in a primary.
This is what we learned from Kinky Friedman and Carol Strayhorn four years ago, right?
Yes, and they did quite well, but they did have some money to throw around.
They turned in more signatures, than the Greens did, but you're right. They had money to spend.
And partially the Greens say because starting after 2000, they got a little bit of backlash from Democrats or people that vote Democratic blaming the Green Party for Al Gore not winning the 2000 election. Ralph Nader became that poster child for all that.
As opposed to old Jews who misread Buchanan as Schwartz in Florida.
Right, and pregnant chads and hanging chads. Right.
And an evil Supreme Court. I mean, all the different
My question to you is, could the Greens be the Tea Party of the left? Could it be the Tree Party, right?
Well, I think more the Libertarians, aren't they?
Yes, because the Libertarians are the organized, not Republicans.
Well, but my thought is, could the Democrats encounter a phenomenon similar to the Republicans where a group at the outermost fringe of their party suddenly takes votes away from their candidates in a close race and tips the scale to the Republicans?
If the Democrats were actually in power of anything, I would think that would be more of a concern. I mean, I don't see, Elliot Neistat losing a reelection bid in Central Austin because there was a Green Party candidate.
But that's not a close race.
The difference between Greens and Teas is that Tea is not on the ballot. The Greens and the Libertarians.
Oh, that's true.
Right. So
that's true.
In all of these polls, you get 3 to 10 or 15% undecided in these races. Even as you get down to October, you'll see these undecideds, and you go, "What the heck is wrong with those people?"
What more information do you need?
Well, some of those are people who say, "Well, I'm not for the blue team or the red team. I'm for the blue-ish team or the red-ish team." There've been a bunch of House races, 3 or 4, off the top of my mind, in the last election cycle, that. A Democrat won the House race but had less than 50%. And it's because a Libertarian bled off some votes. Valinda Bolton in Austin was one of these, for example.
And I think the Libertarian...
You can get these races... if you have a very tight race, any place on the ticket, and you've got a Green Party candidate and or a Libertarian Party candidate, they can pull off enough votes to swing the race.
So in a close race like Linda Harper Brown...
It matters.
Right, where she's running against
19 votes.
The candidate whose name I just like to say on the podcast, Halden Wang. So if the Green Party were to field somebody against Halden Wang...
I feel so dirty.
Then possibly Halden Wang ends up with fewer votes than she otherwise would have, and maybe Linda Harper Brown squeaks in. I'm not assuming that that's going to happen, but it could happen.
Right.
I think the Green Party has had trouble trying to define what exactly they stand for separately from the Democrats. Libertarians have not had that same issue, and the Libertarians have been on the ballot. In the last several elections, you have to get 5% of a statewide seat in an election. And if you get 5% of the vote in a statewide seat, you automatically get your slate on the ballot the next time. Libertarians have been able to do that.
They've always done it in the unopposed court races.
Yeah.
Where you get into a Supreme Court race, and it's usually an incumbent Republican who gets 88% or 92%.
Well, in fact, we have a few of those on the ballot this year where there's no opponent to the Republican.
And that other, sort of the middle finger vote, the 5 to 10% that doesn't vote for the incumbent.
Kind of votes that used to go to Jennifer Gale and Leslie Cochran in the mayor's office in Austin, right? Yeah.
They go to the Libertarians. You just got to get your 5% in one of those races, and you're on the ballot next time.
All right, that's it for today's Tribcast, my final Tribcast before Ben substitutes as moderator next week.
Happy wedding, Elise.
Thank you. Thanks, man.
You will not be Elise Hugh Styles for purpose of the podcast.
No, we're keeping the bylines exactly the same.
Thank you for putting what matters first.
If you have any questions or comments for the podcast, you can email us at podcasts@texastribune.org. On behalf of Evan, Ben, and Ross, I'm Elise. Thanks for listening.